if the product at the end, the manganese being sold to the steel makers, has a high enough price to it to cover the costs of producing from the ore, the actual metal of manganese, then if the price is too low on the product at the end, then we won't do it here. We will not make that investment. We will not develop our own resources. And that's what has happened, is that by forcing the price low, it provides that only the people from somewhere else, primarily in the Caucasus, which was, they were in India too, they were hand separating chunks of manganese ore by hand at a penny a day, or a penny an hour, I guess is what it was.
So that kind of...
You pay human beings a penny an hour to do the work that here, you'd have to buy a piece of machinery or develop a piece of machinery, invent it, and build it.
So you put in a lot more...
So there's cost involved, that's right. And so the price of our manganese here would push up the price of steel. And so everybody says cheaper is better. This is what Tom was talking about, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So the cheaper the better. Well, hogwash. Are we going to employ our own people? Are we going to use our own resources? Are we going to stand on our own feet and be productive of our own raw materials and human labor and inventiveness? Or are we going to exploit people from all over the world so that Avril Harriman can pocket the difference?
Right.
Yeah, I distilled that down to a little line with a few words in it. If high prices are bad, cheap are better. If cheap is better, then free is best.
And free equals slavery.
It's nonsensical. You know,
focusing on cheap as possible production from wherever in the world we want to get it, that means we have to be supportive of slavery conditions wherever we obtain our stuff, because we want it cheap.
But okay. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
But if you depress the disposable income of Americans, which has been going on for a long time, all they can think of is making ends meet.
Sure, that's right.
Mm-hmm. I'm a little late, and so I don't know, did we go over anything to do with Brad Wilson's comments that Debbie sent?
Not yet.
Oh, because I didn't read the Naylor part except for that little paragraph.
Right, I'm with you. Jerry, I wanted.
Yeah, I have it up on my screen now. While I was talking here, I pulled it up. It's not that he's trying to mislead anybody. I think he believes all that stuff because it was common beliefs. It just doesn't happen to be supported by the facts.
Right. And how do you get those common beliefs?
You're right. They're very difficult. I can give you a really quick example of how nonsensical.
Make sure we got Sue's questions handled.
Okay.
Right.
Yep. Sorry about it. Yep.
No, I think people should say their thoughts.
Okay. Well, the mechanism by which importations affect the market prices is not easily explained, other than the fact that the markets where the prices are discovered are, well, what can we say about them?
Manipulated.
It's a manipulated system where the rules are established to eliminate the producer's interest from participating.
Now, do you think the free market works here the way that it's supposed to work in agriculture, when teacher salaries are established, or lawyers' fees, or the price of an appendectomy at a general hospital? You think there's a free market that's some some invisible hand from Adam Smith wandering around setting those prices?
Well, I mean, the free market would be internally inside the United States when it's not impacted by this price discovery bullshit out of Wall Street.
Sure, and even if you eliminated all of the imports into this country, the price discovery system that they have established is just what you said, is bullshit.
Yeah.
It's not related to anything, but traders make money on market fluctuations. Producers make money on stable. Yeah, it doesn't make any difference up or down. But, you know, anybody that produces anything, I don't care if it's a hamburger at the local cafe or cotton, you need a price dependability and stability to run your business and plan properly. We don't have that. And somebody suggests that the futures market is how that's all accomplished. That's even more bullshit than the other assertions about price discovery. It doesn't work that way.
The other thing is, getting back to Brad Wilson, from what I've read of it, has to do with what we're talking about here is that agriculture, it's about food and fiber, not just about food. And Brad Wilson, this is one of the things that I sort of took away. He was more tuned in, not that we shouldn't be, because everybody is worried about, you know, where we're going to get clean, healthy food, but I think that was one of the things that we were trying to bring in, was the impact that agriculture or parity for farming would have on the economy and on producers down the line, which is kind of what we've been talking about in this chapter, these two chapters. But basically, I was kind of interested in hearing Tom or Randy, I don't know if Wendell's here, but the take on if any of you guys read through Brad Wilson's comments?
I did, but I don't recall it at the moment. Let me see if I can get it up here.
Or even Lee, if Lee read through it, Lee being a past farmer.
I had a question about about the He says, especially important are a dozen or more econometric studies of farm bills and parity-related farm bill proposals from FAPRI and APAC. And I was trying to understand what those were, or where they were, or is that something that could help for us to be incorporating into any conversation. I don't know what they are.
Those are academic studies that the endowed chair, so that kind of thing at your university. And I don't believe that they want to understand the concepts of parity that you people and we are and myself are going after and trying to learn about.
Okay. I hear you. Well, this Brad Wilson guy just seems to be sort of, I can't get a read on him. I can't tell whether he actually thinks he's well-informed and isn't,
right,
or whether he's not sure that he's well-informed and still isn't. But either way, he's not what I would call well-informed.
I was sort of thinking the same thing, but I didn't know why. Can you explain a couple of things why you would say that?
Well, he says, I think there's some major limitations in the fact sheet, especially regarding agriculture. So in other words, it did not tick off his little sweetly singing bell.
Right,
That's what he's saying. It's mainly a list of broad generalizations, with few mentioning agriculture. Well, yeah, because we were trying to get away from agriculture, because the point to parity, I told Tom this the other day, I suppose I shouldn't say it in a group like this, parity prices are actually too high. Now, let me explain that. Parity prices are the prices required for agriculture to keep pace with and produce sufficient earnings for the entire economy to stay solvent.
not just agriculture, the whole economy. And so when finance gets out of control, like it is today, then parity prices to agriculture have to go up to cover that additional piracy cost. Does that make sense?
Yep.
It does, but...
Because it's all the debt?
Well, not so much the debt itself as it is the earnings to cover the cost of the debt.
The debt. That's what we would say. Okay, so...
But it's the income. The income side of the debt. There's no balance between the debt and the income side.
That's right. And in fact, hardly any economist you will ever talk to these days will even care about earnings sufficient to cover costs. They don't even consider such an approach anymore.
The national economy can't work that way.
Well, that's what they want you to believe. They want you to believe that you can't work an economy that way. Whereas the truth is that our entire ability to, emerging from World War II as the sole superpower on the face of the planet, was accomplished by doing exactly that. By paying ourselves the proper price for the industrial plant, the agricultural plant, the educational plant, the government plant, and all the rest of the sectors of our economy, and doing it on our own labor and our own raw materials. Can do. Because that's what it did.
My phone disconnected.
All of the rest of the folks have been gathered around the pig straw trying to make sure that the actual source of our earnings and our prosperity are elbowed out of the way so that they can take advantage of the whole thing for their own private gain. And look at where that's gotten us. We now have a president who believes that he can murder somebody under my name. He did that under my name.
He's not the only president that figured they could do that.
That is correct.
I think that demonstrates what happens when we as a people ignore it.
We don't know about it.
That's right. You're right about that. That's the sad part.
How did we know that Obama sat at a table with a kill list every day?
Correct.
Give me a break.
Yes.
I didn't know that. I did after a while.
Well,
but we're
carefully induced to not even ask those questions, I think.
Well, all I'm getting at is this Brad Wilson guy talking about he's not hearing enough about agriculture. Well, we weren't interested in talking to him about agriculture. We're trying to focus on somebody else. We're trying to focus on folks that were not farmers. And so we apparently accomplished what we set out to do.
Okay. Look at it that way.
It's clear that emphasis on economics and economic justice in narrative about parity. There was also great emphasis on labor. We don't hear much about the economic narrative for farmers today, except with regard to local food. The economic narrative for agriculture was much better known and spelled out to the social movements who were listening in past decades, such as the 50s to the 80s, and during the earlier period leading up to the Farm Bill. What do you mean, the Farm Bill? What's that? That doesn't even make any sense to me. National Farmers Organization, American Agriculture Movement, and the 1980s alliances were strong on it. Was the American agriculture movement strong on it in the 80s, Tom?
On parity? Or what was it? What's the definition of it?
I think that's
he says economic narrative for agriculture.
Yeah, well, I was involved. I went to that Farmer Rancher Congress in St. Louis, you know, and subsequent to that, I was the national director in Washington, D.C. of the American Agriculture Movement. On their letterhead, it says, America needs parity. I met maybe two people in the whole organization that understood what parity was. It was an idea that was sold that sounded good. But the reality of it, nobody knew. They weren't stupid. They were ignorant.
Right.
And they'd been kept that way for other people's selfish purposes.
Right.
You know, so that's a whole other story.
Right.
Here, let me give you the newest North Dakota example of what you're all talking about. In 1975, there were short of 5,000 producing dairy farms in North Dakota. Now, a dairy farm then would have been, you know, from some sold cream, but most were selling milk and almost all manufacturing milk, cheese milk, okay? 40 cows to 200 cows, all over North Dakota. As of December 1st, in the state of North Dakota, anybody want to hazard a guess at how many producing dairy farms there are? Now remember, it was 4,800 or some such number in 1975. Milk then was about $15 a hundredweight. Well, I'll help you. There's 54.
Oh my God, I would expect 100.
5 of 4, and the price of milk is $16 a hundredweight. Do the math real quick. And the reason the North Dakota State University Ag Economics Department and the Extension Service had a reason for this massive decline in dairy farms. And nobody will guess what it was, what it is.
What was
a lack of transportation. That means we were so stupid and so far removed we can't get a truck to haul the damn milk.
I don't think that's what they're talking about, Tom. I think they're talking about the fact that there has never, well, nobody's invented the Segway for cows.
Well, that could be. That could be. That would be. I think maybe you should submit a suggestion that the Ag Econ Department or the Ag Engineering Department of NDS, you study that very thing, because it might be more productive than the bullshit they're doing.
Yep.
Oh my God.
But I mean, I was so appalled. This is why there's no cow. What about the price of the milk? Do you suppose that could have something to do with going from 4,800 to 54? You can't make a living on it. It's hard work. You should get paid for your work. Eventually, you quit.
So
somebody calls that supply and demand. That's not supply and demand.
No.
We're eating ice cream and we're drinking milk. Maybe we don't drink as much of it because of the way the economy has structured and kept mom from being at home and kids doing X and Y and Z and all this other stuff. That may be true.
Sure.
We've changed our diet.
Say it's lie and demand.
Yeah, well, that's right.
Well,
but that's not the issue with the dairy industry. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Tom, would there be a, in the case of, what was it, manganese or some ship that came into the Caribbean that ruined the market, you know, that lowered the price 30% on the Chicago market that Randy mentioned earlier?
Soybeans.
Or soybeans, thanks, Randy. What was out there? Was there a foreign product that brought down milk? You know, we're drinking the milk.
The biggest reason that, in my judgment, and I've never been in the dairy business, but the advocate, when it was faltering, in my part of the world, we were producing all this manufacturing milk, making cheese, and the markets for cheese seemed to be, I don't know, but I know the federal government was exporting a lot of cheese in giveaway programs.
We were also exporting a lot of milk powder.
Yeah, one of the two. They could convert it into powdered milk and export it. Now, I can't tell you it's because we weren't consuming. I don't know the answers to those real strategic questions, and I should. But I know that in about 1995, when they established the milk futures market, I was on the Board of Trade's Ag Advisory Committee in D.C. when that came up, and I just absolutely was railed against. You can't put, if you put milk on the futures market, that'll be the end of dairying industry in America. Well, I'm not saying that I know more than others, but it ended the dairy industry as we know it in America, and it didn't help the consumer, and it sure didn't help rural America.
Yeah.
The futures market controls the price of milk. It's the tail wagging the dog.
Well, no, actually the pool, the milk pools, the marketing orders determine the prices of milk. That's a whole different subject right there.
Yeah, it is. But the advent of the futures market fixed it, in my judgment, so that you can't achieve.
How would that not be related, Andy?
Well, all I'm getting at is that the people running the pool stuff, the marketing orders and the pooling, have been, well, it's just like the Interstate Commerce Commission, the ICC. When it first went into operation, it did a whale of a job. And then, of course, the people who regulated decided that they could create the experts that got sent into Washington to take over the control of the organization so that they could get their own people in place to make the rules. And that's just what's happened with milk marketing orders, too. What it comes down to, essentially, is there is no equitable philosophy available to supervise the operation of these bureaucracies. Somebody's always got their finger on the scale.
Well, we can't see those people. They don't appear. They're not easy to identify, point your finger at them. They're there, and they're working, but the public isn't aware, and Congress is oblivious, because nobody's contributing to campaigns that
we reap the benefit by having a cheap product that we think makes our dollars go farther.
Yeah.
So we're
yeah,
in better
right.
economic health than if things were not so controlled. Meaning controlled in the fashion that they are today.
So that brings me back, Brandy, when you said parity prices are too high. Could you explain that a little bit?
Well, just that the costs of running our financial system the way we are have added so much cost way we do business that
yeah.
the price of raw materials has to be pushed up so high, that's what the parity prices, that would be needed if we paid them to put us on a solvent basis, are way out of line with the world prices because we are the source of the world inflation. We are the source of the, that's why the Federal Reserve note is the reserve currency to the planet.
Well, what will likely happen is what's been happening. There'll be some kind of financial collapse, which is a mechanism to rinse out bad debt or debt that's can never be paid. You rinse it out and you start over, but you don't fix the cause that created the problem in the first place because there's too many people making too much money.
Yep. And they get their.
That's not free enterprise. That's not free enterprise or American capitalism, by the way. That's a lie. That's an absolute lie.
Capitalism, right?
Yeah, well, it's certainly been corrupted vastly. And I don't see a way out. Now, Randy and I have talked about this endlessly. The likelihood of getting rural America, whether it's farmers, ranchers, and the inhabitants of rural America, the people that live in towns of less than 5,000, let's just say, to rally around and demand that the economy be run for all of us, I think the odds are better that we're going to, the people on this phone call are going to influence the trajectory of the next rocket to the moon. I don't think it's going to happen. I don't think we can cause this to happen, I may be out back to Vince Rossiter and Charles Walters. We have to make this information available when the time happens that it's necessary. It's essential to keep the country afloat. And maybe I hate having that, you know, that sad commentary, but it doesn't seem that anybody is interested in it. Well, I can give you, a North Dakota example. A friend of mine who has a master's degree in ag economics and has a farm and all this stuff and has won through the farm crisis and was a credit counselor for the Department of Agriculture to help people restructure debts and all that stuff. He called me the day after New Year's as he cashed the second half of his check. He had a quarter of land 5 miles from his home that was his grandfather's homestead.
But it wasn't described what a quarter of land is.
Yeah, 160 acres, a square, a half mile by half mile, 160-acre chunk of land. It was, 80 to 90 acres tillable, a little pond in it that was natural, and a lot of rocks. He sold it to the guy that bordered it for $1,675 an acre. And Greg said he was almost guilty, because he knows the value and how to calculate and does all the math and all that stuff. He said, I almost felt guilty for taking 20 times what that piece of land is worth.
Mm-hmm.
He said, but I didn't. No. Now, why, and this was a beginning farmer loan for the money from the government, it had nothing to do with that quarter of land or that kid that bought it, his ability to pay for it. It had something to do with making balance sheets functioning so the banks can lend more money.
Right.
That's it. There isn't two reasons.
Explain that. Explain that. Give an example of what you just said about the bank's balance sheet.
If you are, let's just say you owe $100,000 to a bank, and the collateral is your income and your chattel property, your livestock and machinery, and you mortgage the land. So that's their security. You can't make payment. You can't cash flow because your income is too low. And now you've borrowed enough, you're up to the value of all those assets, and the bank has no room to lend you more money because you're borrowed up 100%. You've borrowed up the value of the assets. Well, you just get the assets revalued.
Oh.
You erase the number and have proof that the land that you were valuing at $500 an acre is now worth $7.
Because your neighbor sold it for that.
You became solvent by lending somebody else money to establish a price for the commodity, for the land, and you've got similar land, so therefore yours is worth that, so your balance sheet just went up and you're good for another year.
You can't trust those bankers.
But their business today is to get Washington to bail them out. Mm-hmm. All the rural bankers, they've been screaming for about 2 years. They need a bailout.
Wow.
Oh, boy.
And nobody seems to be very interested in giving them one. Now, whatever that means, I think what it's going to mean, there'll be a collapse, and the land in this country will change hands, and the Chinese or Europeans or somebody will come in and buy it all up. And that's the end of liberty in America, when you change who owns the country. And that's where I'm projecting, and maybe I have some sour grapes here, but that's how I view it when I know what the land is worth. It's worth what it will grow.
Well, what you can get—that's the return on the thing, right? And when corn.
Yeah, but I mean, you can't.
Is it $3?
You can't artificially, at the end of the harvest,
when beef is at half of what it needs to generate in order to turn that land over, that's all you can. That's what Tom's saying. It's all you can do is just calculate what it will earn on a yearly basis.
Yeah.
Well, it's not like having a factory that makes T-shirts, and you're not making any money on T-shirts, so you convert it to make pots and pans. You can't do that in agriculture. You don't have a big variable here on what you can do. A piece of land is good for what it's good for, and that's about it. I guess we could all start a tourism trade. You tell a story about the Missouri mule, about the two farmers that traded the mule back and forth. Every time one of them got the mule, bought the mule from the other guy, they always paid a little bit more for it. First it was $1,000, and then it was $2,000, and then it was $4,000. And they got trading back and forth. About every 6 months, they'd trade that mule back and forth. Of course, the mule never quit working in the field, and the money never changed hands, but they bid it up to the sky's the limit for $30,000-some-odd, and of course, one day the mule dropped dead.
Randy's virgin.
Yeah, they were both lamenting the fact that the best thing they ever had just suddenly went away.
The only thing they ever made any money on.
That's right.
Yeah, Randy's virgin, that's a little different. Mine is a horse, but it turns out the same, you know?
Well, that's like the land in what Tom is talking about, you know? You bid it up, the guy comes along, the banker comes along and says it's only worth this much, and then another banker comes along and says, oh, no, we can lend more than that. We can value that at $700 an acre. Oh, no, $1,000 an acre. Oh, no, $3,500 an acre. And on it goes. Whether they will actually turn that sort of income to pay that sort of a debt, it does never enter into their heads. They look at a piece of paper coming from their regulators or their bank examiners.
Yeah, they got their balance sheet financing. I think that's the way the housing industry is operating, by the way.
Yeah, I think
nationwide.
What they did, they're doing that.
But the only way you can afford to be building and building and building the houses is to inflate the value of the ones that are there so you can use them as collateral to build a new one.
So when you've been able to manipulate prices the way that prices are manipulated, like in the 80s, I have this article from Huffington Post where the farmers, that was the, you know, the farm crisis in the 80s, were losing all their farms. Well, one of the things was the mortgage companies were declaring based on earnings, so the prices of the crops were going down deliberately. And so they didn't have enough of the farmers, they were calculating the worth of the land, evidently, and so they were underwater on their mortgage, even if they were making all their payments on time.
That's right, yep.
Yeah, so the mortgage was, the land was worth more than the mortgage. So anyway, they were foreclosed upon, even though they were, you know, in full faith, and because of
as I put out before, the shock absorber from 1952 through the Reagan era was Farmers Home Administration. It tailed up when a bank had a borrower who had borrowed up all his equity, who was no longer solvent. The bank would sell the debt to Farmers Home Administration. The Farmers Home Administration would pay it off in full and reamortize it. For the farmer, you'd put it on a long-term loan, or you'd give low interest rates, or you'd do all kinds of stuff, and then the farmer would go back into the bank and borrow more operating money until he had borrowed that up again. Well, Reagan put an end to that.
Mm.
They stopped it. The cycle just stopped. Wham! And there was the crisis. Now, I'll give you an exact example, not theoretical. In the summer of 1983, I wish Wendell was on because he was farming.
I am.
Are you? Well, the summer of 1983, all across the Corn Belt was a terrible drought.
Yes.
Horrible. And all the predictors were saying this is going to be the worst disaster in corn since the Depression. Now, mind you, corn isn't harvested until October. Let's just say October. This is in June. It was inordinately dry. The corn market skyrocketed, anticipating a poor crop. Every week it was just jumping and jumping. Well, there's an old rule of thumb. For every dime a bushel, corn goes up, the price of cattle goes down a penny, because corn is the main ingredient in producing the beef. So the cattle market collapsed as the corn market boomed. And it went to lows that nobody had ever imagined, the cattle market, okay? By September, it was at depression level prices. Now, mind you, no corn had been harvested. This is all theory.
That's all happened in the futures market.
Yeah, yeah, all of it was speculation in the futures market, and they were convinced that this was, oh my God, woe is us, woe is us. Well, the people that I knew said, well, the disaster isn't nearly as bad. Corn crop is better than what they're saying. There is some real poor corn, but it is really not bad. Didn't help. The market stayed hot on corn, and the cattle market went to depression level areas. I know that because I had the equivalent of about 10 million Big Macs on the hoof. The market collapsed. The bank said, sell them and we will repurchase. Well, I did. They didn't. By February of 1984, within 6 months, I sold fat cattle in Dakota City, Nebraska, for as much as they're getting today. The highest market in history cost me $900,000 in 3 months. Now, those are absolute real statistics, and it was all based on speculation and not real numbers. That doesn't make you very confident in the market or the price discovery system that we're being told works.
Well, I want to get back to talking about this Brad Wilson thing. Right?
Sure.
Can I just, Randy, before you do that, Randy, it's Sue. Before you do that, I just want to make a comment and see if I'm understanding it. So, the New York stock market is to the price of stocks as these futures commodities markets are to the price of production off the land?
Similar. It's close. There are futures trades regarding the stocks, yes, to some degree. Mostly what the standard Dow Jones Industrial Index is, that's just an average of the prices of the stocks that they've chosen as their elements in their index calculation. That's all it is. They identify what stocks are included. I don't know how many are there, 20?
But it's the gambling, the nature of the gambling. It's the nature of gambling. It's they're both doing gambling.
Yes, of course they are, and they're using other people's money to do it. The difference in the agricultural markets is that not only are they using other people's money, they are using mythical quantities of commodity that do not exist.
Well, they short sell. They short sell in the stock market.
Here, in a given year, there's 10 times more bushels of corn traded in the futures market than exists.
Or will exist at the end of the season.
Whatever, yeah. It's mythical. It doesn't exist.
That's mind-boggling.
It is. It truly is. I mean, if you explain that to a kid in high school, they'll just laugh and say, you're just making that up.
Yeah, you're pulling my leg. You're lying.
Yeah. Yeah, when I tried to explain it to my son, who's pretty smart, who's in Japan now, I said, the futures market is buying something that you're never going to get and selling something that you don't have.
You don't own. Yep.
And he said, that's not possible. Well, that's too bad. There's a lot of people that make a lot of money doing just that.
Cash big check.
The people that are producing it it's not affecting people that have an 8-to-5 job so much as it is affecting the people that produce the raw product.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're affecting the balance of the payments in the nation. That's what I...
Yes, truly, but on a micro basis, they're affecting people that produce that commodity and related
community. The money system is the community's responsibility, because it is what the community owes the individual producer. And when you let private interests mm-hmm. begin to control the amount of money that is available for accomplishing anything within the community, instead of having the community decide for itself, then the community has lost control of its destiny, of its ability to accomplish for its members what it needs to do. It cannot do that anymore. You have been taken over. There is the coup.
Well, there's
been the loss of government control.
We haven't observed it. It's happened so slowly that it hasn't been noticed.
Yeah, I think a lot more. I don't know if anybody listens to Catherine Austin Fitz. There's another guy in our group, Howard Switzer, who a neighbor of Catherine Austin Fitz. So he tries to approach her every now and then. But she gave an end-of-the-year report on, I don't know, the state of what she writes in her Solari report. But she was talking about farmers, and she was saying, to her, we need to go local at the county level. She says there's plenty of resources within, these more local or regional areas where we depend on each other. In other words, she's basically, the way I understood what she was saying, was talking more in terms of a par exchange economy. She wants to do an end run around the banking. But the other part of what she was saying was that farmers this year, she didn't give the numbers about the farmers that were going under, but she says it's really astronomical.
Right.
Yep. Which I thought was,
Well, the measurements of how you calculate that are pretty skewed. What they measure is the number of bankruptcy filings per state.
Okay.
And the reason those numbers are, first, that's only one form of farm liquidation, the filing of a bankruptcy. The most common liquidation form is the bank says, we'll let you have your car, just give us your stuff. And it's never recorded. That's the common mechanism. And Farmers Omen used to always take care of it. The reason the numbers have gone up is because people are struggling with what to do, and they will find out that Chapter 12 bankruptcy is a total fraud. It doesn't work. Nobody will win except the creditor. It's a trap. Once you're trapped in the confines of the bankruptcy court, they will eat your lunch. And the entire Chapter 12 bankruptcy system, through the reform they did back a few years ago, it was gutted. It didn't work very good before, but it was literally gutted. And so there's a lot of trouble out here, but it hasn't hit the shit hasn't hit the fan yet.
Well, I think it's hitting as we speak. It's just that it's such a slow rate. Everybody's used a certain amount of shit hit them, and nobody is paying attention anymore.
Well, I was with my brother-in-law, who's an agronomist and runs a big agronomy unit for a big farm co-op in South Dakota. I think he did $5 million in chemical and fertilizer sales last year. And he was explaining to me, through the infinite wisdom that he has and all his education from South Dakota State, that farmers at $3.50 a bushel on corn are making piles of money. They could do it for a lot less. They could take a lot less. And I said, well, that's kind of interesting. Yeah. No, he was expounding to me how much money they're making.
Wow.
Believing it.
How does
There's no sense in me having a discussion with them because they've already made up their mind on the facts that they sort out to rationalize and justify their position. They don't want anybody throwing a monkey wrench. I'm the guy that's throwing the clod in the butter churn, and it's not appreciated. You know?
No, definitely not.
You recognize that, yeah.
Yeah, well, I get unappreciated a lot.
The information that Sue had on that report that she did on the World War One war debt that I'm hoping is going to get out soon,
mm-hmm.
inside those things really tell us the story of our economy. And what we're talking about is how to make the economy work.
Right. Yes, and that's that. Catherine Austin Fitz has a. There were glimmers of insight to what she was saying with how the economy really works. You know, we have to make things. She was saying. So I think, and most people don't understand that. They think making, you know, gambling on Wall Street is the way to do it.
Mm-hmm. Of course they do.
And so I guess I would say that. You know, part of our job, and maybe this guy Wilson had some ideas like a better history. If we plan to do some kind of a Hoover-style document, white paper, whatever, we could do like some of the legislation that, I think Randy and Tom were mentioning certain pieces that we could probably include in our explanation and the history part of it. And how that impacted farmers from the parity period forward. But I think the history goes farther back than that.
Well, that's one of the things that this Brad Wilson mentioned. You know, I mean, it's there's a need for telling the story in terms of the massive amount of newer data on agricultural economics. Especially important are a dozen or more econometric studies of farm bills and parity-related farm bill proposals. From FAPRI and APAC. Well, FAPRI, I can tell you, is not worth powder metal to hell. And APAC is coming out of, Daryl Ray.
Ray, Daryl Ray.
Yeah.
He's just got as thick a skull as any bull you're going to run into.
So the ones that
lots of conversations with him. But finally, he says, this is Brad Wilson, we need a better history of the invention and rise of the parity programs and then of their decline. The history of the farm bill as presented in the 21st century, such as in the new food books, is full of major myths that point us away from an adequate understanding. In sum, we need to strengthen the general economic narrative of today's farm bill, yada, yada, yada. Is he unable to read Unforgiven? Is he unaware of the Norm website? What's his story here? I find it hard to believe that he could spout these words and have.
I was thinking I was understanding them.
Well.
But you're saying, you know, that.
Well, the.
We talked to my wife and I talked about it today when we watched the documentary today on the American Experience on public television about the history of the Chinese in America. It's not been told. It's incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, it's mind-boggling, and mm-hmm. the point that hit both of us is that none of us know about this.
Nope.
These are huge events and mm-hmm. horrible events.
Yep.
You know, and we're unaware. If we're unaware, we don't have much reason to try to make it better or mm-hmm. acknowledge that the wrongs that were done were wrong. We need to fix these things. And number two, we watched a movie at the theater not long ago called Dark Water.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if anybody's familiar with it. You ought to watch it. It's really, and watch it close. Now, there's some stuff in there I disagree with their conclusions on, but it's about a lawyer who sued DuPont. And to me, it tells tells us how the American legal and political and economic system are so damn dysfunctional. And we could fix them, because they're dysfunctional because of design and intent, mm-hmm. not because of us. But we don't, I think we feel powerless at these forces. But if it's exposed more and we have a conversation, we might come up with enough political persuasion that something might happen. I don't know, but what we've been doing, this is my frustration, hasn't worked.
Well, that's one of the positive things that from Catherine Austin Fitt, because she was saying we need to get on the same page about a few key systemic problems. And for her, gold is money. But, you know, Howard's been trying to talk to her about that. But anyway, mm-hmm. she was kind of coming closer to the idea, you know, just like William Jennings Bryan said, till we solve the money problem, all the others will not fall in. We can't fix the others. We've got to do this one first. And so the money problem to me is tied in with equitable trade and farm parity.
Well, absolutely, you can't separate.
Right.
You couldn't fix one without dealing with the other. It's the same thing that would amount to if you could implement farm parity and not have a parity minimum wage, the exchange equation won't work, because people wouldn't have enough earned income to consume what we produce. Those things they're inextricably linked together.
And that's really how the Constitution was set up, was, you know, with the tariff. They didn't, in fact, I think Wilken is not in that chapter, one of the chapters, is not talking about equitable trade. I forget what he's talking, the way he's expressing. I think he talks about trade through the proper tariffs.
Right.
But to me, the equitable trade is, you know, a piece of work. It's really a thing of beauty, the whole concept behind that. Developed by Norm.
Well, you know. That's exactly what parity is, too. It's just equitable trade domestically.
Yes, right. Exactly.
Well, it's really a legal mechanism of how we would treat each other as we would like to be treated, if you want to get down real deep into
it. And it doesn't have to be, you know, what we've got right now is all these band-aids, you know, oh, we're going to have minimum wage, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, and, you know, let's make another law and add it to the 100,000 that are already on the books, or how many hundreds of thousands there are. And then we can get a whole, you know, battery of lawyers in D.C. to go ferret out those laws and make a case against you, or whatever. The game is rigged.
Well, you know, this is really not very new. That's one of my favorite Jonathan Swift quotes. Laws are like cobwebs. The flies and the gnats get trapped. The wasps and the hornets break right through. Now, that was in about, I don't know when Jonathan Swift was writing, 1700, something like that. But this isn't very new. This is not new.
Right.
It's just that in America, I think we had a better handle on it than any place in history, and we lost control.
Well, we didn't lose control. It was taken.
Well, well, but, you know,
parity was killed intentionally.
Oh, for sure. Because it works. You know, who suffers under a parity system? If suffering is it? How about banks that create money?
Money lenders.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't have we wouldn't need their product.
Yep.
We would earn our way. You know? And out of those earnings, you build your community, because now you can build another building or make Main Street paved instead of gravel.
Well,
now we don't. We just borrow it, you know. That's what we do. We borrow it.
Well, when we've come to believe that if the money has to come first, why, if we could only get the money, we'd be able to do all this stuff.
Well, I would have to
I had more money, I could buy more stuff.
Until you listen to Fritz Hollings. You remember what Fritz Hollings?
Yeah, I know that.
Fritz Hollings is a senator from what, North Carolina, South Carolina?
South
Carolina, I believe.
I think South Carolina.
Yeah, there's too much consuming going on out there.
Well, I'm not contributing my share, I can assure you of that. Well, it's a
I was disappointed in this Brad Wilson thing, because I think he's just, I'm glad he responded. That's good. And apparently, like I said, we hit the market not being focused too strongly on agriculture. But what is in his head is that apparently he thinks that all the parity folks have died and never did anything other than talk about it 70 years ago. And,
okay, yeah, right.
Well, it sounds good, but, you know, you got to dig a little bit deeper to find out what it really means. And when Walters would say, you know, farmers aren't the object here. If the public understood what parity means, they would be at the farm gate with guns, not allowing a farmer to sell anything for less than parity prices, because it's for the broad economy, not for a farmer to get rich. And that's really the crux of it. That's why I was critical of that that came from that George Naylor, you know, that other piece that was in there that floated around from Debbie Hillman and that about the genesis of the farm crisis. I'm sure he believes it. It just doesn't happen to be true.
Right. And that's what I'm wondering, is this kind of like a gauge for what the farm reform communities are talking about, are thinking about, are, you know, because these presumably are more farmers and consumers that are more in keeping with our way of, you know, our perspective. But
one likes to think that, but it does give me a lot of concern.
Yeah.
Wendell can comment on that. I just heard the president of North Dakota's Farmers Union state categorically that we need a farm bill that can open up all kinds of foreign markets so we can sell more stuff.
Yeah, I've heard that.
I know how to sell more stuff. Give it away. How about that?
That's what I feel like telling them.
You know, well, everybody that's involved in the export business is making money. Everybody, except the guy that produces the commodity that's being sold.
Yeah.
You know, the guy that's hauling the corn in his semi, he doesn't care what the price of corn is. The guy that's selling tires to the guy that's got the truck, or the insurance agency that's selling him insurance, or the elevator that's hauling it and who's loading it onto a ship and sending it to China. They don't care what the price is. They just take their margin.
So I was thinking, like in our little group with Lee. Were you still on the call? Lee? I guess he left. Anyway, our little group in Elgin, there's a farmer there. There was also another fellow who was a gardener, but he raised blueberries and stuff. The farmer is creating his own little localized economy. Because what they do, they've got a team. One is responsible for the actual farming, and the others, one handles the books, and the other two go and establish relationships with local restaurants and food stores for their products. And they tell them why, you know, theirs are, they have fully pastured beef and chickens and turkey and what else. And so they're kind of establishing a little bit of what Catherine Austin Fitz said, you know, going local. But there, it takes a lot of work to establish the distribution points, because Jean Sexton spends a lot of her time going into the city and other places where they can find drop-off points with enough of a clientele to make it worth their while. So
distribution is always the challenge.
Right. And the same thing is true for our for my co-op, because she has Amish farmers, I forgot his name right now, in Wisconsin, but she also sources a couple of things in Indiana, and she's the one that she goes and picks up from these farmers. So the Amish up in Wisconsin, they kind of live in their own little community without, you know, a whole lot of interaction with the rest of the bigger community. But these other producers in Michigan and Indiana, they do. So, but she's creating her own little hub. We've got, I think she says, like 300 families on her distribution. So she has 3 drop-off points. But that's what we've been doing that for almost 20 years.
Right. Yep. Yep.
And I'm kind of like Tom, a little bit down in the dumps. Like, is there a way to get out of this without, you know?
Well, there's a comment, I think it's over in chapter 12, where Wilkin talks directly about this local, returning back to the local areas, and he was disappointed himself in the fact. He said, when you do that, and that was one of the, well, I guess I should do that. He talks about the local solution will simply, it may save a few people, but it needs to be done at the national level so that all folks, classes, segments are included.
Well, if you drew a line through the United States, somewhat west of where Jerry is, so let's just say in the middle of where I, North Dakota, brought all the way down to Texas, just an arbitrary line, west from there, all the things that Jerry is speaking about, as good as they are and as necessary are, and as workable as they are not very applicable in that everything west of that line, because there's no people and lots of land, and we also have winter. So the seasonality of it, and I'm sure here we're no different than anyplace else. The rise of farmers markets here in the summertime has been phenomenal, and it's really great. And you get good stuff, you know, and all that stuff, and it's most of it is priced a lot more than a grocery store, but you're getting good stuff. But it's just what Randy said. It affects a very few people in a very positive way. We get better nutrition, you know, we get better food, we get healthier.
Well, this is the nature of what are called institutions. Mm-hmm. Social institutions, cultural institutions. Do we institute a distribution system that all of us contribute to make it exist so that it works for us and our needs? Or do we not? Do we let someone else take over the institution we had and ruin it so that they can make the money we used to make out of it? And take that money out of our community.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to make a comment here, if I could, Randy.
Please, Lee.
I wanted to make this comment a lot earlier, but the conversation was going long, and I couldn't get in. I would like to add a personal footnote. I used to work for the summer jobs for the 2 summers for the Great Northern Railway, which goes across northern North Dakota.
Right.
And 2 summers for the Northern Pacific, which goes across southern North Dakota.
Before they became one, yes.
Right. They're 2 separate ones. But the thing I want to make, and regarding the milk distribution, I can remember, because I get to ride a lot of trains free because of the work that I did.
Right.
It's part of my job. But at every single stop along the way, there were milk cans, these gray milk cans that were maybe 2 feet high and had these heavy metal
lids. Cans. Yeah, they were cream cans.
Yes. these cans were at every stop, And the ones that were full of cream would be put on the train, and the ones that were empties would be put back on the
loading dock.
Yeah, right. So the railroad would just transport these cream cans to and from the creamery and back to the community.
Yep.
It was just done every single day, both on the Great Northern and Northern Pacific. But the reason they could do that was because at the time, the railroads were responsible for transporting mail.
Right.
And then somebody decided, nope, we need to get it there a little bit faster, so we're going to send the mail by trucks. And that basically shut down the railroads. They just became major freight things at the time.
Exactly.
So we actually had a distribution. I know they had it in North Dakota and Montana, Minnesota, and I assume it was the rest of the country as well. There was a distribution system there that worked for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And it seems to me we could do that again. And if you look at Europe, they didn't get their train system. Their train systems work. They keep them. And they work for everybody all over Europe. They could do that here again.
Yes. Right.
They could do that here again.
We could. All of those things are actually more easily achievable now than they were when they did it. We have the technology that makes it all simpler.
I'm not sure we have the tracks we had then.
Uh-oh. But I mean, you could have local production of meat, milk, and eggs in our local communities, and the train can haul away any of the surplus. But we could do those things.
It's just like you can do.
Who you have to fight to get that re-implemented.
Yeah, and the entire Randy is familiar with this, and so is Paul Griefentrug, because they have access to raw milk. I don't know about Illinois, but Wisconsin and Michigan have raw milk. It's illegal to sell raw milk in North Dakota.
Yeah, Montana too. We've got through Weston Price, you get distribution.
That isn't about human health. Let me tell you.
No.
That's about money and control.
Mm-hmm.
And it sure as hell ain't about a better product either.
That's
none of
like
those things.
Laws that are very simple. 3 pages long, like Dennis Kucinich writes, no longer.
Yeah, no.
Or shorter.
Yes.
Well, Lee, was that, did you have more to add?
I wanted to add one other comment, but it's different. It refers to banks.
Uh-huh.
If you look now, I think you live in Michigan, so you know better, but it's my understanding that the guy who owns Quicken Finance is buying real estate like crazy in Detroit.
Probably, yeah.
Detroit real estate is virtually worthless. This guy is going to use his funds, buy up all these houses, and they're starting to sell these to, fix them up and sell these to these Islamic groups that are coming over there.
Mm-hmm.
And he's making a fortune. So they displaced the auto industry, let it crash, and now the banks are just coming back and making money like crazy.
Well, he's not the only one, the Quicken Finance guy, because J.P. Morgan, Jamie Dimon himself, has been investing in Detroit real estate as well. And in fact, he's been financing rebuilds on a block by block basis, not individual homes or houses, but blocks of houses. I don't know that he is yet, but how far down can you get before the price is right? The deal with Dimon was that he only picked this up when he got called on the carpet, essentially, publicly, for claiming that he's worth $30 million a year. And that this was considered to be a bit gauche. And so he decided he better do something, so he looked around for the cheapest place he could put some money into to get some return. And he picked Detroit real estate. tells you how far down Detroit's real estate market actually is.
Yeah.
But, oh, golly gosh, he was lauding his efforts and that of the local real estate group, or the redevelopment group, I guess is what it was, because they were talking about how you couldn't do it on a house-by-house basis. You had to do it by blocks, and sometimes by entire communities or areas, several blocks, in order to bring the entire inventory of housing up at the same time.
Yeah.
Well, who's he going to sell the houses to?
Well, this is part of the deal, is that they're putting the investment in with no expectation of standard returns. It would be just like what Mariner Eccles proposed in 1933 about refinancing farm mortgages on a 30 or 40 year basis. In other words, you call the debt over and take a new mortgage on the current assessed value or appraised value and finance it over a 40 year period instead of what they were before, which was probably 10 to 15 years. So that the repayment schedule is greatly reduced and the properties become financeable again. So they do it with an eye to the future, because if we'll put the money in now and we'll get it back later as you pay us the debt that you now owe us because of the good deeds we did.
But it's a game that's been played over and over and over again. It's,
well, here's the alternative. This is what frustrates me, and I can speak for Randy on this, which I rarely would want to do. Every major city or even minor cities in America has urban blight. They need rebuilding. There's infrastructure that's a disaster. There's housing. If you want to fix urban, the inner cities in America, just pay the right price for wheat and corn. And by magic, that will all fix itself. Now, that sounds pretty crazy, but it is, because we can create the money through production that can make our lives better if we choose to.
Right.
Well, I just had another question here on whether private enterprise or banking as we know it needs to end.
Private enterprise. Wow.
Private enterprise needs to end? No.
Well, that's Joe's on.
I don't think Joe, banking needs to change, not private enterprise.
Yeah, no, private enterprise, small C capitalism, or I think we talked about it before, people's capitalism?
That's, yeah, it's covered in. Yeah, that's right.
All new wealth comes from the soil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, which has nothing to do with what we've got now, international finance capitalism,
or could you call it
centralized surveillance capitalism is what we're moving into.
Drone.
I think we're probably there, don't you think?
Yeah. Yeah. Sure. All these cookies.
I think
bread.
More so than probably we're aware of. I'm afraid.
Yeah.
And what I'm dismayed at is the public that I'm in contact with that has bought the bullshit.
Well, as far as answering Joe's question, whether private enterprise or banking as we know it needs to end, private enterprise doesn't need to end, but private enterprise cannot exist if banking is going to persist in the way it exists today.
Yeah,
well, that needs to be reformed.
Banking, as far as I'm concerned, if I were building the new society, there wouldn't be any banks. We'd have a treasury and as a place to store the money that we are not circulating, and that's all we need. We don't need no damn banks. We don't need no banks.
No stinking banks.
We don't need
banks. Well, Randy Cook just took care of his spot on the local Chamber of Commerce, I can tell you that.
I won friends and influenced people.
Yeah, one friend you've got. Yes, that's it.
Well, I don't see anything wrong with banks, as long as they're locally, they're controlled by the state charters, not the stuff we got now.
We don't need them.
Well, for storing money, that's one reason why you would need them. You might need a loan once in a while, small loans.
So? Do you have friends?
Oh, okay.
Jerry, I've had this argument okay. with Randy. I always lose, you know.
Thank you. I thought I was.
I know, I'm erasing too much. I understand that, and it's uncomfortable and all of that stuff. I get that. That's why I usually keep my mouth shut. But the question was right there, and so I thought I would stick it in there.
Well, this is really good, but I think I've got to go.
Yeah, I do too. It's been a pleasure. Good night, folks.
This has been great. I learned a lot. I think we have to continue chapter 11, no? Good for me. Yes, yeah, well, our meetings, our membership meeting is 6 to 8 Eastern Standard Time. No, I don't have to go to it. Well, there's a break from 8 to 9. Okay. I didn't record the whole thing, but as we started around, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes into it, I said, I have to record this because I have to study it. So I can put it up on my website. I'll put it up on my website and send out the link.
And it'll be a continuation of the discussion on chapter 11 and 12.
Yeah, a lot more
on
that next time. Yeah, include chapter 12 because that's really the one that I was sort of aiming at. It tells the beginning, the story of the beginning.
Okay. Maybe we'll give a real brief overview of 11 and then move right into chapter 12 and spend most of the time there.
Yeah, that would be better. We could even forget about 11 if you want to.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you could come back always to 11.
Yeah, we can. Yep.
The whole everything you said in the beginning applies, Randy. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay.
Everyone take care then, I'll look forward to 2 weeks. And thank you, Tom. Thank you, Lee. Thank you, Joe, Randy, Jerry, everyone. Have a great day. Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye for now.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Bye, everybody. Thank you so much.